So today, as I said earlier, Caleb's out of town for the weekend, so we're going to take a brief break in his 1 Corinthians series. And today, I'm going to be doing the first of a series. So there will be a few weeks gap between this sermon and then the continuation of the series in July. I think I'll be starting the second week of July. So I know we will all have slept many times since then, but as best as you can, try to keep the things in mind from this week as we go forward into that series later. And I will do a rehash when we restart that one. But basically, the series that I'm going to start is going to be called The Good Shepherd. And what I'm going to be doing is tracing Psalm 23 throughout the rest of the Bible. Because one of the things that you really need to pay attention to as you read the Bible is patterns. And the shepherd, the good shepherd theme, is a pattern that's repeated multiple times throughout Scripture. And I actually really like that Kurt read the passage where Jesus was talking about himself as the good shepherd. That is one of the passages that I'll be speaking through in that series. And what you'll see as we work through different passages that develop it is exactly that, that it does develop throughout the biblical narrative. And if I remember correctly, there are 9 passages that really team and kind of piggyback from Psalm 23 as the biblical authors develop the Good Shepherd theme throughout the Bible. So this is the first one and kind of where it all starts. So what I want to take some time today is to work through a lot of these elements that we see in Psalm 23. And then as we work through the rest of the text later, we will see them repeated, tweaked, developed. Some of them will drop out for a while and then come back in. And you're going to see this process that happens with the Good Shepherd. And what this process is called, by the way, is biblical theology. And biblical theology is basically tracing something throughout the biblical narrative. And you can do a biblical theology of anything. If you want to start right at the beginning, you can do a biblical theology of creation and follow creation language all the way through the Bible. You can, if you staying in Genesis 1 through 3, you can follow snake imagery. There's a ton of snake imagery in the Bible, by the way, and you can follow that develop throughout the Bible. So that's pretty much biblical theology. And these last few years especially, I've been really getting into biblical theology. And to me, it's kind of a check against myself because I used to be, until recently, more of a systematic theology guy. And you may or may not know the difference, but basically systematic theology is kind of just grouping all of the texts that have to do with something together and systematizing it. That's why it's called systematic theology. And systematic theology is really good, but good systematic theology always has to stem from good biblical theology. Because you can't just study a word, which is what systematic theology tends to do. It tends to almost be like an expanded word study, which is great. But if you don't know the context that those words are coming from, you can actually really have a distorted view of systematic theology by not having a good base of biblical theology. And if you're curious more about the difference between the two, you can talk to me more offline later. But basically, just more and more of the last few years, I'm really getting more and more passionate about biblical theology. So I apologize in advance. When I speak, you may have more and more biblical theology series come up. And by the way, that doesn't mean that I'm not speaking exegetically, because good biblical theology is always done through good exegesis of the text. It's not like I'm going to be ripping random texts from the Bible and just kind of like saying, well, this does this because I say so. It's like, no, it does that because it is following a biblical pattern that is developed throughout the Bible that fits within the context as it develops. And that'll make more sense as I develop it throughout the series. So long story short with that, this is the start of a series that there will be a gap in developing later. So kind of put a pin in this and some of the stuff you hear, and I'll recap later when we restart it again in July. That being said, I'm going to reread Psalm 23, and then we're going to start to work through the text. Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in the path of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. How many of you had to memorize this as a kid? How many of you still have it memorized? I'm doing this because I kind of have like half of it memorized. This is a extremely well-known text for good reason. This is an extremely rich text. One of the authors that I was reading recently, he's into like biblical archaeology and stuff like that. And he said that the Good Shepherd theme or motif, whatever fancy word you want to use, was like the theme that the early church keyed in on for the first like 200-300 years. If you like, he's really big into like the ancient sites and like the burial sites and stuff like that. Like they had shepherd imagery everywhere. Like this, the theme of God as the Good Shepherd and later Jesus as the Good Shepherd is, I mean, they're just hundreds, thousands of years of rich digging into the text and applying it and thinking through what that means for us and what all of these images mean. So I am well aware of the fact that I am not like giving some revolutionary new, like this is a text nobody's ever heard before. Like I am well aware of the fact that you, half of us, as we just saw, have this text memorized or had it memorized at one point. It's a very familiar text. What I hope to do with this sermon and with the series going forward is hopefully help us to look at a familiar text on purpose. And why I phrase it that way is because the more familiar a text gets, the less we actually see it. If you think about that, I mean, how many of you, you do the same drive pretty much every day? Now, if I asked you, Samuel, you're driving already. Now, if I asked you to name 10 things you see along the way, I'm betting if you've driven that route a few years, you might actually struggle to name 10 because you just zone out like most of the drive. And I mean, you're almost going from memory. So if you actually name something, you'd actually be surprised that what you name might actually, how you describe it might actually have been true 3 years ago. And it's actually changed since then. Because again, the more you interact with something, the more familiar you are with something, the less you see it. So what I want to do today, and as we go forward in the rest of the series through the rest of the Good Shepherd text, is to help us pause and actually see what is in the text as it was intended to be seen. So Psalm 23 starts with, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." Again, one of the most familiar lines in the Bible. So I want to start working through kind of word by word, just what is actually going on here in the text. First, the Lord is my shepherd. What does that mean? It's a title, it's a word that's become so familiar, it's just kind of this feel-good, fluffy thing. The Lord is my shepherd. Cool. And then if I ask you what you mean by that, like, I mean, everybody can give vague answers to it. And I'm sure we all have personal answers to it as well, like times in our life where we felt like we were shepherded by God, whatever that means individually to us. But getting back into the context of what this meant when it was penned, there are quite a few things going on here. The first thing to remember is that, okay, who was this written by? David. What was David when he was a boy? A shepherd. So he undoubtedly has a lot of knowledge about why he's writing this. This, the Lord is my shepherd, is written by a shepherd who shepherded sheep and then later was called a shepherd of people. So he has much experience being a shepherd. And it's not like this stuff that he's writing in this whole chapter here, he's just like pulling out of like imagery that's just, it was imagery that's popular in the day, but it's also imagery that's personal to him. There's nothing in this chapter here that wouldn't have made sense to him, and he has this big context in mind that he's saying. So there's the personal level here, but then there's also the national level. And why I mention that is because the shepherd theme and the shepherd imagery and title is actually something that at an international level at that point was actually a very big image. We think of it exclusively as like the shepherd with the sheep imagery, like a literal shepherd with literal sheep, which is definitely going on. So what I'm about to say does not say that that's not happening. But on an international level as well, shepherd was ironically a deity claim. Because pretty much every single nation at that point, one of the terms for their main god was shepherd. The Egyptians, the Egyptians, I think the Assyrians were at the time, all the nations around them, shepherd was one of the titles for their god. So this was, it's a dual claim here. It's a deity claim. And because in the start there, it's like the Lord is my shepherd. So what David is saying is that, like, I know all the other deities are claiming to be shepherd, but like my Lord, the Lord, he is my shepherd. And as you obviously read through the rest of Psalms and the rest of the Bible, David's ultimately claiming that he is the shepherd. Like, all these other ones are just false claims. Like, our God is the shepherd. So this is a deity claim, but then also it is actually a metaphor about God being a shepherd and kind of how that applies to God's love for us. But one of the things to keep in mind there with getting back to the deity claim is that why it was used for the deities and the nations around him is that it was a protector God who cares for his people. And I think that's entirely appropriate for what David is doing here in the Psalm. So I think at both levels, both the literal shepherd to sheep level and the deity claim level, both of them match exactly what's happening in the Psalm here. And then the next phrase is, I shall not want. That is a phrase that, depending on where you are in history, where you are geographically, where you are financially, where you are economically, whatever it might be, like, you hear that different. And especially in consumeristic America, we hear that different than other nations and other times might hear that. At just a purely selfish level, we think, I shall not want. We're like, awesome, I get everything I want. It's not quite what's happening here. One good thing to notice, Psalms are really good with this, but also honestly, it's more places in the Bible than you'd think are purposely arranged where, according to kind of the literature at the time, there are actual structures that are happening with the wording and the grammar and the placements and the phrases and stuff like that. What's happening here? Notice in Psalm 23, and you can just skim it as I say this, where are the first person pronouns? They're in verses 1, 4, and 6. That is on purpose. Verse 4 actually, kind of genre-wise and in a literary way, should be two clauses, actually. And what you have here is actually a series of seven. I think the author, one of the main authors that I've been working with, he calls them cameos. And why he does that is because he's one of the guys that I've been following who develops the Good Shepherd theme throughout Bible, the whole Bible. So he calls them cameos. So they keep showing up in other places, just like cameos in movies or whatever. But what he points out is that, okay, in one, you have the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Skip to four. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Skip to six. I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. What's interesting is if you take out the rest of the chapter, that still makes sense. If you read one, the beginning, the middle, and the end, it flows perfectly in a cohesive unit, which also shows what's happening with the structure here. I think everybody's familiar with the word because Caleb and I just throw it out there once in a while, chiasm. Basically what's happening is it's going out, it's kind of like ABCBA, pretty much. So it works its way to the middle and then works its way back out with everything echoing each other. So the first part and the last part echo each other, and ironically the middle is the most important, which isn't really how we read things here in America because that's not how we write. But that was actually an extremely common writing method back in this time. And actually in much of the Bible time, because if you read through even New Testament texts, a lot of them are structured like that. But basically what's happening is if you echo them together, the first part and the last part meeting and matching each other, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, and then skip all the way in, I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. That's what matches it. So what you see in the structure of the psalm here is the want that David is talking about is not like getting everything you want. The want is what you actually need, which is to be with God. And then in the middle there, it says, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. So what David is saying, because again, like the first and the last part mirror each other, and then the middle is the most important. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He is my protector through whatever, and I will dwell in his house forever. So he is my protector, and he is my source of comfort. And then you will also see in the middle that he is my source of provision, in the parts in the middle that echo each other. So this isn't like the Lord is my shepherd and he's going to give me whatever I want, the whole like name it and claim it type thing. That's not what's going on here. David is saying the Lord is my shepherd. He will give me what I actually need. And what I need from him is for him to be my God, my comfort, my source of daily provision. And we'll get into what that means in a little bit. But he's my home, essentially. When I have no other home, he is my home. So the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. As I was studying into what is going on here with the imagery between the sheep and the shepherd, what the shepherd is doing for the sheep here, one of the things that is insanely clear that David is trying to make clear in the whole psalm is that the sheep are incompetent. And if you know anything about shepherding and sheep, like the things he's keying on here, the shepherd is literally doing everything. And many commentators, as you read through stuff, what they'll try to point out to you is that like this psalm is not about the sheep. So as many cool facts as there are about like how sheep act and stuff like that, and I'll be pointing out some of those things, ultimately this psalm is about what the shepherd is doing. And that is what David is keying in on. And if you tie that with the middle part, verse 4, 4a, there being the most important, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. He is more than likely, I mean, think of the life of David, how many trials and struggles he went through. Now, granted, he brought half of them on himself. But all the things that he's going through, he's more than likely penning this in a time where he is like, I am in deep darkness here. I am a lost sheep who is helpless without God. But God is my shepherd, is my protector and my sustainer and my comfort, no matter what. So getting back to verse 2 here, and why I kind of jumped forward and said that it's all about the shepherd. He makes me lie down in green pastures and leads me beside still waters. These verses are very poetic and sound very pretty. But it's really fun to actually know what's going on and what's required to make this happen. Because I have found out so much that I didn't know about sheep researching into this text and researching into the other texts going forward throughout the Bible. So he makes me lie down in green pastures. What this sounds like, because of how the English has been translated, is basically what we could envision. Now, again, I know I'm talking to people who have probably heard a bunch of sermons in Psalm 23, so I apologize if a lot of this is repeat. But what's not happening here is you do not have a shepherd that looks at the sheep and says, lay down. Like, if that was a dog, the shepherd could do it, because dogs actually listen to people. Sheep, not so much. They kind of just really do their own thing, and they don't ever lay down until they've gotten enough food, they've gotten to drink, and we'll get into what's required to make that happen. That's a lot of work. And there aren't any predators in the area. And there aren't any pesky flies or anything like that. And there aren't any snakes on the ground. And there aren't any poisonous plants. And that, blah, 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 blah. They need a lot. And then finally, when they're ready, they lay down. And what's required to make that happen is a lot of work and sacrifice from the shepherd. Which, hold on to that thought as we go through the series and develop what's happening with the Good Shepherd and what Kurt jumped forward to with Jesus being the Good Shepherd and the work and sacrifice he put in. But he makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. I want to get into a little bit of all the work that's required to make this happen. So he makes me lie down in green pastures. In that area of the world, there are green pastures like 2 or 3 months of the year that are easy to find. The rest of the year, the shepherd has to lead the sheep to wherever the green pastures are. And he's not the only shepherd. There are shepherds from other tribes, other peoples, shepherds of higher status than him, shepherds that have more land rights than he does. the shepherd's got to do a lot of work to go from place to place to get to the green pastures. And also says that he leads me beside still waters. Now, why is still waters important? To me, like, not knowing anything about sheep, when I first heard it, I'm like, okay, it's just like this serene, beautiful picture, like they find a pond or something like that. Like, okay, that's all well and good, but there aren't actually too many of those around that area. And what you actually tend to have is just like streams and rivers and different things like that, or you have wells. And why it specifically says he leads me beside still waters is, if you didn't know this already, sheep refuse to drink until the water is not moving. So if you bring them to a stream, you bring them to a river, they will not drink, even though there is abundant water right there. They will just look at it, like, sadly, kind of walking around, trying to find an area where it's not moving. So, like, you can bring a flock of hundreds of sheep to this just abundant source of water, and all they're going to do is wander back and forth, trying to find somewhere they can drink. So what the shepherd has to do is, if he's at, like, a stream or river or something like that, he actually digs and creates little channels, little dead ends for the water, that can give the sheep a place to go drink from still water. Or if it's at a well, and again, he's probably not the only shepherd there. Now, a lot of this might have been built ahead of time because wells are obviously used regularly. But the initial setup near a well is obviously the sheep are not just going to go dive into the well and drink. They need to get the water out. And then you're not going to have like hundreds of buckets to give to each individual sheep. So what you do is you build a trough or you dig a trough or you do something. Again, a lot of work and sacrifice on the shepherd to make this happen. Because the sheep aren't going to do anything and aren't going to drink, even though the water's right there, unless the shepherd has put in the work to make all of this abundant water available and still. And then, like I said earlier, he also has to kind of prep the ground around them. So he, or if he has dogs or assistants or whatever, they make sure that there are no predators in the area. A lot of times they even have to go ahead of time and kind of make sure there are no snakes or poisonous plants or anything like that. Basically, there is a lot of time and effort involved in the investment of making sure these sheep can lay down and have still water. And what David is saying here is, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And then he gets into the provision, and he's saying, God loves me so personally that he does this work and lays the groundwork and does the prep work to get me to a place where I can lay down. Then it says, he restores my soul. This one, sorry if I offend people for certain translations, but I'm, at least based on the research I've done, I'm not terribly a fan of that translation, the he restores my soul. It's not an impossible translation, but it's basically giving a metaphorical wording to a literal thing. By that, what I mean is that the words that are going on here, he restores my soul. The Hebrew words that are happening is he brings back my life. The word for bring back can also mean restore. The word for life can also mean soul, but those are actually alternate meanings. And it's not that like the translators are totally wrong. That is a part of the meaning, but I think it would have actually been better to leave it back at what it more literally means, though. Like, I hate the word literal in biblical translation, because all literal means is that it actually matches the intention of the author and the context and the genre and everything like that. I think what actually matches better here is that other meaning of he brings back my life. Because if you follow the shepherd imagery, so you have this shepherd who supplies what the sheep need. So he gives them their provision. He gives them their food and their water and their tranquility. And then he also brings them back when they are lost. Which entirely and easily fits within the shepherd imagery. Now, you can spiritualize it and say that he restores my soul, but I think we should step back and start where the image starts and then get there and not just skip there to the he restores my soul. So what's going on with the he brings back my life, or however you want to translate it? Sheep aren't very good, if they don't know the way, at staying on path. That's why a shepherd has to be really on top of his game about leading them. We'll get into more of kind of the instruments of the shepherd, but jumping forward a little bit. So David used a sling to kill Goliath. That was a common shepherd tool. And what they would use the sling for, and why he was really accurate with it, is they would, depending on the context, assistants or dogs or whatever, anyways, a lot of times if the shepherd's behind, he would have the sling, and he would sling it at like a tree or a rock or something like that to startle the sheep that are straying and get them to go back into the group. So that's why he's really accurate with it. He's used to flinging it and making it hit like a rock or a tree or something to create that noise to startle the sheep back into the group. So, again, getting back to the fact that the sheep aren't terribly good at finding their way without a shepherd, when a sheep goes astray, the shepherd has to go get that sheep or he suffers loss. And depending on the context, a lot of times the shepherd isn't watching his own sheep. He's watching somebody else's sheep. So that's a knock to his reputation. And we'll get into that in a little bit. If he loses sheep. And what's interesting, getting back to what I said earlier about sheep are really incompetent, is that when a sheep gets lost, it doesn't just like, oh, I'm lost, it turns around, finds its way home. It's not like they have like really good sniffer like a dog or whatever, they can find their way back. Apparently what a sheep does when it's lost is it just like hides in a rock or like a bush or something like that and just like sadly bleats until it's found, which, you know, is great when there are predators in the area. So what the shepherd has to do once he realizes that a sheep is lost, he has to go find it and hope that a predator hasn't gotten there first because this sheep is giving away its location. So he has to go find the sheep and then restore or bring back the life back onto the path of righteousness or the right path. So again, like with the wording that's happening here, what the translators have done is essentially skipped to the spiritualized version of what is happening here. Because this, he restores my soul and leads me on the path of righteousness for his name's sake. If you go back to the shepherd imagery, it's actually he brings back my life and leads me in the right path. For his name's sake. Like, that's the shepherd imagery that this is based on. In other words, the sheep has gone astray, and the shepherd needs to go save it and bring it back to the fold by bringing it back on the right path for his own reputation. Because if you're known as a shepherd that loses sheep, you probably don't have a job anymore or livelihood. So it is very important to your reputation that you are a good shepherd and don't lose your sheep or let them get taken by predators. And then, again, with the translation here, restores my soul, leads me back to the path of righteousness. I mean, that's obviously that's where you'd go with that, with the spiritual truth. So again, they're not wrong, it's just they've kind of skipped a step. So with that, what David's essentially saying here is that in 2, God gives me provision, he gives me what I need for the day, and then when I go astray, he brings me back. And that's what's going on with many of the translations that you'll see in the English text, is when I've gone astray... He brings me back onto the path of righteousness for his own reputation. Now think of David. What is a very glaring illustration of this happening in his life? Think of David and Bathsheba, where he's really gone astray. And then God sends a prophet to bring him back on the path. And then you have the beautiful Psalm 51 that's penned after that about how he acknowledged his wrong, repented, confessed and repented, and came back on the path of righteousness. So that is a picture in David's own life of what you see him picturing here with the sheep. And what's also interesting is if you think about that context, you think about the sheep who's just sadly bleeding and like not helping matters at all. Like, David was not on a path of getting back to the right path at that time. He was just kind of off doing his own thing. He had committed adultery. He had murdered people. And he was just like, well, I'm good. And if you actually know kind of the historical context of the area, in his mind and then kind of like the national, like at least the international secular morals at the time, he was fine. He kind of covered all his bases. He killed all the people who like had a beef against him pretty much. And he was of higher status than anybody else that could say anything. So like technically he was in the right at the time because he'd killed all of his opposition. But what God is saying is like, no, that's not how this works. That is wrong in my eyes. I don't care if you've smoothed everything over according to the cultural morals that you're using. Those do not match my morals. And then God sends a prophet to help bring him back onto the path of righteousness. So again, in these first 3 verses, what you see here is an incredible amount of work from the shepherd and not a lot of work from the sheep. Because again, the whole point of this psalm is what the shepherd is doing and who the good shepherd is. So he restores my path and leads me on the path of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. The valley of the shadow of death. I was just at a funeral yesterday, and this was read at the funeral. This phrase is one of the reasons why it's one of the most commonly read chapters at funerals. And for good reason. It is an amazingly beautiful and comforting psalm. And by no means am I saying it should not be read at funerals. But one of the things that's also going on with the wording here is that the shadow of death is one of the possible translations. And I think, again, kind of like what I was saying earlier, we need to go maybe back a step, would be what's going on with the wording here is basically the valley of shadow or the valley of darkness is pretty much what's happening here. And again, the translators aren't wrong. They're, long story short, a good way to understand translation is always, ultimately, to some extent, commentary. And that's what many translators have done with Psalm 23, is they've essentially created somewhat of a commentary of it to jump forward a little bit to what the words mean. And that is not bad. It's a translation philosophy. But what's going on here is I walk in the valley of darkness. And again, David being a shepherd, he knew exactly what this meant. And you can easily fit this into the shepherd imagery and what would be a norm for shepherds and sheep at that time. A valley of shadow, what that would refer to is, it was a mountainous region that the sheep and the shepherd are all walking in. And there are some valleys between mountains that's literally the only way you can go. And it is oftentimes a valley that has been kind of created by a river that eventually erodes and creates a deep cleft between the mountains. And the thing about that is if you have a skinny, kind of worn path that's the only path, do you think shepherds and sheep are the only one who know that? Who else would know if people have to go only one way to get somewhere? People with not so good intentions. So why this would be called the valley of the shadow or the valley of darkness is that this is a bad place to go. But sometimes it's the only way to go. And that's actually what you see in the psalm here. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. So like David's like, I am well aware that this is a place I will probably have to go through at times. And what's interesting though is even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, meaning that he already anticipates he's getting to the other side. And why he could say that is, again, extending the shepherd imagery, is a good shepherd knows how to protect his sheep through that valley. Now, whether that's knowing the right time to go through there or knowing the right show of force to make sure you don't get heckled or whatever on your way through, also potentially knowing what predators are in the area and how to defend against them. But even though I walk through the valley of the shadow, I fear no evil. And again, continuing the metaphor of like, basically David is putting himself as the sheep. And he's saying, I am this sheep that there is this valley of shadow that I need to go through. But I know that I can get through it because you are with me. And I actually want to step back a moment here and just broaden out our understanding of what it means to be a sheep and a shepherd in this context that David is talking about here and envisioning because he did it. One of the things that is really shown here in the Valley of the Shadow, but is true in general of any context of being a shepherd with sheep, is that as soon as you leave the village, at this time there were no cell phones or anything. You're on your own. So if you're a good shepherd, you are entirely responsible for your sheep from the moment you step out from civilization. You are their security. No matter what comes, the sheep need the shepherd to protect them from whatever, especially in the Valley of the Shadow of Death, but ultimately everywhere they go. They need their leader, they need their provider, they need their comforter, and they need their protector. So David says, I am a sheep, but even though I walk through this valley, I know that my shepherd is there. I will fear no evil, for you are with me. What's amazing here is if you follow the grammatical context of what's happening and following, as nerdy and mundane as it sounds, following the person of what's happening with the pronouns here. There's first, second, and third, and seeing who it's referred to. This grammatically is a pivot point in the text because we've just worked through the middle, the most important one, part four. Part five, in kind of how their literature worked for this type of structure, part five is supposed to have some sort of kind of like sudden and important change. And what you see here, what that change is the word you enters the scene. Because until now, it's been I and he. A bit, it's personal on David's end, but the he, the God, is kind of more impersonal. It's the third person. And all of a sudden, it's the you, the more personal second person. Meaning that David is talking now more directly to God. And as we'll see developed later on, and especially in the text that Kurt read earlier about Jesus claiming himself as the good shepherd, is I think this is a foreshadowing of the incarnation here. The you, God coming onto the scene and being with David. You are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. It's important to pause here and to distinguish the difference of the two instruments that are referred to. You are with me, your rod and staff, they comfort me. The rod and the staff are two different weapons that are each designed for a specific purpose. The rod is offensive, to defend against external threats. The staff is more defensive, to defend against more internal threats. What I mean by that is when you read rod, I don't know about you, but because it's easy. Like we tend to modernize everything. When I usually read rod, I almost think of like a police baton or something like that. A better way to visualize it would be like a mace, pretty much. What was commonly used at that time was a wooden rod that had metal embedded on the end. So it was essentially a pretty ominous mace that would do some damage if you hit something. And when you actually read David defending his ability to fight Goliath to Saul, what he says is that he took on, I think it was a bear and a lion, and he said, I grabbed the lion's beard and I struck him. That implies he had something to strike him with. And almost certainly it was this rod. He essentially smacked the lion in the face with a mace. Like, the dude knew how to fight and to take on enemies. And that's essentially what he's saying to Saul, is like, okay, I may be this little boy, but like, I'm a shepherd. And if you didn't know, shepherds have to fight. Like, we need to be able to protect our sheep. So I've gone up against bears and lions, and I, through the strength of God, can go up against this giant. Because he'll protect me just like he did against those beasts. So that's what you should think of when you think of rod. And then staff, staff is more of our, I feel like we're pretty good about this one, because if you think about like the shepherd's hook and stuff like that, I mean, we have some in our gardens. It's a pretty common image. It's the long hooked staff that shepherds have. And it was normally about 5 feet long or so with a hook on the end. What the intention was is it's a long stick that, depending on where the shepherd's walking, he can kind of like tap them, get them back into line if they're going off. What he can also do is, again, with sheep being incompetent, is if they fall into they're down a ravine or something like that, he can use the hook to pull them back up without hurting them, because he's got this hook to kind of get under them and guide them back up. So the rod defends against threats from without, and the staff defends against threats from within. In other words, the rod protects against other things happening to the sheep. The staff defends against the sheep themselves, because sometimes they need help from themselves and their own incompetence. So your rod and your staff, they comfort me. In other words, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear nothing, because you are completely in charge and protecting me both from without and within. And then, interestingly, in verse 5, he kind of switches metaphors a little bit. Which, again, the whole thing's a metaphor anyway, so he can really do what he wants. And then we'll also see this develop later, and teaser for Luke 15, which actually Caleb talked about already, so I'm trying to steal too much of his thunder, and I'll be looking at it from kind of a different lens when we go through it anyway. But all that to say, Jesus, when he talks about he has a sheep shepherd parable, and then he has a lady with a lost coin parable, and then he has a father and lost son parable, that is on purpose. What David is doing here in the psalm, he starts with shepherd and sheep, and then he's going to jump here to people at a table, which we'll develop this in a little bit, but God is actually fulfilling the role of a woman here, culturally speaking. And then at the end, he talks about himself dwelling in the house of the Lord forever. So you have like sheep, and then you have a stereotypically female role, and then you have a person dwelling in the house of God. Man, that sounds a lot like Luke 15, that Jesus developed and fleshed out even more. So again, this is on purpose. So you prepare a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. There is a lot of cultural stuff going on here. Basically, switching metaphors to a host hosting a guest. And what you'll see as we develop it, a very honored guest. And ironically, hosting this honored guest in sight of people that hate the guest. And culturally, if you hosted somebody who the community around you hated, guess who the hate gets transferred to? You. So God here, in the role of the host or hostess, culturally speaking, is putting himself in position to have the hate of the enemies transferred from David to himself. Another teaser flashing forward a little bit, and this is actually a text we won't develop beyond the fact as it relates to other ones, but this is very similar to what you see Jesus doing with Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus was a person in the community that the community did not like. He was a tax collector who had been cheating them, as we see that he had to repay people. And Jesus says, I am going to eat at your house. That was a big deal back then. And what he essentially is doing by doing that is he is taking the hate that the community gives to Zacchaeus and being willing to transfer it and claim and own some of it for himself and put himself out there for Zacchaeus. So that's what's happening here, is that God is essentially putting himself in a position where he is going to be hated because of who he is honoring. And he says, you prepare a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. You anoint my head with oil. And this is where the honor comes in, the honored guest. You anoint my head with oil. This is basically a host pulling out all the stops and saying, not only am I going to host you with a good meal, I'm going to give you anoint my head with oil. I'm going to give you some good oil. Essentially what that's doing is that's the host self-sacrificially giving the guests oil to anoint their head, which at that time they didn't shower as much. So oil on the head helped to create a good smell, helped to also preserve the complexion against all the sweat and the heat of the day. So it was a very kind gesture. And culturally speaking, a host, like, so nowadays there are rumor mills like, well, this person has this big of a house, or this person has this big of a car, or like this nice of a car, or whatever. Like at that time, it was this person offers this nice of meals. Like that's how you kind of like show how much you're honoring somebody or show off your wealth. Like if you attained a ton of wealth, you threw a huge meal and provided people with more food than they can even eat. That was how you showed off wealth. So essentially what God is doing is he's pulling out all the stops here and anointing the head with oil of this guest that he's honoring in the presence of enemies. And then it says, my cup overflows. So not only is the host making sure that the guest feels welcome and honored, he's making sure his servants are literally hovering at the guy's shoulder. Because what's happening here with the imagery here, with the cup overflowing, imagine you're at a restaurant, and every time you take a drink, a server gives you more of whatever you're drinking. And that's happening so often that it's literally overflowing because they're so eager to do their job that they're giving you like too much. You can't even keep up with how fast you're drinking. Like that is how much honor that the host is showing to the guest here. In the presence of the enemies. So you anoint my head with oil, my cup overflows. So in the text up till now, again, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. So he provides me with what I need. He brings me back to the right path. Even though I walk through the shadow of death and of darkness, I will fear no evil, for you protect me from internal and external threats. And then he switches metaphors a little bit. He says, even in the presence of my enemy, you make me feel welcome and honored and provided for. And then he switches back to the sheep shepherd metaphor and says, surely goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life. Why I'm saying he's switching back metaphor there is actually sheep on their way home. Ideally, if they know where they're going from, they can lead themselves home. Not always the case, depending on where the shepherd had to take them. So a lot of times he has to like get them to go back down the right path home. And depending on how well he is staffed, if it's just him, he has to go to the rear. Because if you have a big group of sheep that are all heading in one direction, heading home, especially if it's the end of the day, the shepherd's a little tired, not paying as close attention, guess what? You might have a young sheep or a sick one kind of wandering back a little bit. Guess who's following to see if that happens? Predators. So normally this following me back home, this is like a bad thing, normally. Because sheep don't want something following them back home. Unless it's the shepherd following them back home and being their rear guard. Now, depending on how he's staffed, if it's just himself and they know the way home, he would go to the rear and protect them. If he has a dog or assistants, they would be in the rear and he would be in the front. So it really just depends on the context. But basically, what David is doing here is he's personifying goodness and mercy and saying, you, the good shepherd, are goodness and mercy following me. Now, why I want to point that out and say that that is personifying the shepherd is because it's too easy to read that and say, goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life. So we pair that with the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. We read that as Americans, it's easy to see, okay, I get everything I want, and then goodness and mercy are with me all the days of my life. Yes. Like, life's going to be awesome and peachy and no harm, no darkness, no nothing. That's not what's going on, especially if you realize that that middle stanza is the most important one, even though I go through the valley of the shadow of death. Like, there will be difficult times and there will be hardness. But the comfort is that our God, our shepherd, is with us. And that even as we walk back, and continuing the shepherd metaphor, even on our journey back home for the end of the day, he is still watching us. His guard never slacks. He never gets too tired at the end of the day to forget that he should be in the back watching to protect us from predators. So goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. So this is where he kind of switches metaphors again, which again, like he's just kind of, he can do what he wants here. I dwell in the house of the Lord forever. So basically, again, like the goodness and mercy God personified is following him back and protecting him on his way back. And what he's saying, his ultimate desire is to get home and to be with God in his house, which at that time was the temple. So what he's saying is that ultimately, you give me what I need and you help me find my home in your presence. Now, like I said at the beginning, there are a lot of themes happening here that are traced throughout Scripture. So what I am not going to do right now is say there is one main point. Unless you want to say that God is the good shepherd. But that means a lot. And why I don't want to say there's one main point, one main takeaway from this, is because that robs the text of its richness. The point of what's happening here is that David is giving us a picture to look at and to dwell in and just to enjoy the richness of all the parts of what he's saying here. And I think that's one of the many reasons that Psalm 23 is such a treasured psalm. You can look at any individual verse and get so much from it. There are so many aspects to what being a good shepherd means, to what being, if you're in verse 5, what being a good hostess means. So what I'm going to mostly say first is to encourage you to continue to look into Psalm 23 and the imagery that it's using, and maybe think through the rest of the Bible. Okay, where else does that show up, and how is that developed throughout the Bible? And keep these thoughts in mind as we dig back into it in July, and we'll continue to work through this stuff. But for now, what I want to do is just kind of summarize what's all happening here and really just leave us with an encouragement. And it's the encouragement that David was giving himself, which again stems from 4 being the center there. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil. Essentially, David, in whatever point of life he's in, we all know he went through so many various trials in his life. He's saying, no matter what happens, God is my shepherd. Even though I go through darkness, even when life is difficult, even when I don't feel like I can provide for myself and I don't have what I think I need, God is my good shepherd. God ultimately gives me what I actually need. He gives me the nourishment that I need each day. He gives me the protection that I ultimately need, though that may not feel like the protection I want to have, because I don't want to be in these situations. but that ultimately he is the good shepherd that brings me through to the good end that he has, even if that good end is the eternity with him in heaven. Because as we were talking about this morning in Sunday school, one of the ways to waste suffering is to simply think that beating your suffering is getting out of it to a peaceful life on the other side. Beating your suffering is trusting God through it and enjoying his presence even in the midst of it and being a witness to the world of what it means to have hope no matter what. And that doesn't mean that you're necessarily smiling through it all. Life is hard. Read the Psalms. David knew that. But we also see, no matter what happened in David's life, he turned his eyes back to God and found comfort and solace there. And ultimately, there may be a shadow of death that lasts a long time or that you never get through. But that's why God has promised us that he is in with us in this life, giving us what we need, and that this life is not the only life. In fact, we tend to go astray when we live that way, that this is the only life, and we forget what's actually important. And one example, getting back to the nourishment that he gives us, he leads me beside still waters, he makes me lie down in green pastures. It's easy to read that as an I get what I feel like I need for the day. There may be days where you don't feel like you got what you should have had or what you felt like you needed or wanted. But ultimately, God gives you what you need, and that is him. Even if you feel like you're at a point in a life where I'm really struggling right now, I don't have this or that or whatever it is, I go back to the imagery of Psalm 1, where if you delight in the word, you are like a tree planted by a river of water, and you will flourish. And what that means is that no matter what life throws your way, because of God, you have what you need to get through that. Whatever that actually means for your scenario. Because when we hear get through that, we think, awesome, it's going to be like happier on the other side. It may never be. But that doesn't mean that God is not there with you and that he can't give you the strength that you need to get through it. So that is ultimately the comfort that we get from Psalm 23, which I know isn't the comfort that we want to hear. We want to hear that life will be better, though. We want to hear name it and claim it theology. We want to hear that if I trust in God, he will make everything comfortable and I'll never go through darkness. I'd argue, though, that what we get is far greater. We get a God in Scripture who overcomes any darkness because he can give us the strength to get through it. Let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you for this psalm. I thank you for the beautiful encouragement and reminder that it is to us that you are our shepherd. And that no matter what life throws our way from outside or from inside our own hearts, that you are there with us. And that you are fighting for us to give us strength, to lead us back, and to lead us home. I pray that as we go our ways this week, that we remember that. That we remember that we are your sheep and we need our shepherd. I pray all this in your name. Amen.